This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy. Support for the world comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/the world. That's odoo.com/the world.
The world is watching, all of us today. So here's my message to those beyond our borders. America has been tested, and we've come out stronger for it.
I'm Marco Werman. From Asia and Africa to Latin America and Europe, the world is watching the start of a new chapter in U.S. relations.
This new dawn in America is the moment we've been waiting for so long.
For many, that's meant waiting for the U.S. to work with global health leaders to fight the pandemic.
Otherwise, the whole world really gets the problems and is sicker and unsafer.
Dealing with that is priority number one. A lot at stake for President Biden all over the globe. Our coverage coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It is now official. Joseph Robinette Biden is the 46th president of the United States.
This is America's day. This is democracy's day. A day of history and hope, of renewal and resolve. Through a crucible for the ages, America has been tested anew, and America has risen to the challenge.
Even before Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris took the oath of office, reactions started pouring in from across the globe. India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi said best wishes and that he's committed to working with the U.S. Germany's president called this a good day for democracy. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson welcomed Biden to the job.
I look forward to working with him and with his new administration, strengthening the partnership between our countries and working on our shared priorities, from tackling climate change, building back better from the pandemic, and strengthening our transatlantic security.
UK opposition leader Keir Starmer also chimed in.
Can I also welcome the inauguration of President Biden and Vice President Harris? It's a victory for hope over hate, and a real moment for optimism in the US and around the world.
In Pakistan, Prime Minister Imran Khan said he looks forward to working with Biden. Not all of today's reactions were warm and fuzzy, though. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani took a parting shot at Donald Trump, saying these last 4 years created problems for the American people and those around the world. From China, a government spokeswoman said Beijing welcomes Joe Biden's decision to rejoin the Paris Climate Agreement. She added that Trump had seriously damaged U.S.-China relations and that the new American president needs to meet China halfway. A spokesman at the Kremlin said today's inauguration makes no difference to Russia, and the country will seek good relations with the United States. Biden's inaugural address today was aimed squarely at a politically divided America. He was also speaking to people beyond U.S. borders, as presidents before him have done as well. With more on that, here's The World's Sarah Birnbaum.
Most inaugural speeches are famous for their rhetoric about unity. Think of Thomas Jefferson's, "We are all Republicans, we are all Federalists," or Abraham Lincoln's, "We are not enemies, but friends." Biden's speech had a lot of that, too.
I will be a president for all Americans. All Americans.
Inaugural speeches and inauguration ceremonies in general are supposed to bring the nation back together after a divisive election. They're supposed to signal peaceful transitions of power and a stable republic. But presidents have also used inaugural speeches to send a message to the rest of the world. Take FDR.
The Bill of Rights remains inviolate. The freedom of elections is fully maintained.
In 1941, when Franklin Delano Roosevelt was sworn into a third term, Nazi Germany was taking over Europe and Japan was taking over the South Pacific. FDR used his speech to say that fascism would not win.
Democracy is not dying.
The most famous line of John F. Kennedy's 1961 inaugural speech is, "Ask not what your country can do for you.
Ask what you can do for your country."
But there was also this warning to Russia that the young American president would not allow the U.S. to be bullied.
Let every nation know, whether it wishes us well or ill, that we shall pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe, to assure the survival and the success of liberty.
Donald Trump had his own message for the world in 2017.
From this day forward, it's going to be only America first. America first.
Trump used his inaugural address to make it clear that multilateralism was finished. Today, Joe Biden's inaugural speech was a direct repudiation of that stance.
We all understand the world is watching all of us today. So here's my message to those beyond our borders. America has been tested, and we've come out stronger for it. We will repair our alliances and engage with the world once again, not to meet yesterday's challenges, but today's and tomorrow's challenges. And we'll lead not merely by the example of our power, but by the power of our example.
America is back. That's Biden's message to the world. Back as a global leader, back as a beacon of democracy, back as a partner on the world stage, and ready to join forces with other nations once again. For the world, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
In many ways, today's events in Washington are changing the balance of power everywhere. Donald Trump aided and supported and identified with strongman leaders across the globe. But as the world's Rupa Shenoy reports, Trump also united the protesters pushing back.
By his first full day in office, there was an unprecedented mobilization of protesters against Trump.
Show me what democracy looks like!
This is what democracy looks like!
The Women's March was the largest single-day protest in U.S. history. Afterward, noted Harvard sociologist Theda Skocpol and other researchers tracked protesters as they sought to continue their activism.
Suddenly, people turned up at Democratic Party meetings that had been nobody there. I would describe it as a revitalization of the roots of the Democratic Party.
Skocpol says new grassroots groups also sprang up across the country, many led by women, and their collective efforts paid off pretty quickly.
Well, first of all, it made 2018 possible, which was really important. 2018 was a turning point.
The newly mobilized activists phone banked and went door to door for the midterms to elect, in many cases, moderate Democrats. Skocpol says they increased voter turnout with a broad coalition.
The way they looked at it is any Democrat that can build a majority, we're going all out for them. I think they saw it as a way to save the country, really, from Trump and Trumpism.
Then Minneapolis police killed George Floyd, and people protested racism and police brutality in countries across the globe.
Black Lives Matter.
Black Lives Matter.
Arisha Hatch is vice president of Color of Change, a group that leads campaigns for racial justice.
This past summer was certainly, I think, a very, very transformational moment. We saw more non-Black people joining protests. We saw corporations speaking out for the first time. And it happened in the middle of a pandemic.
Movements have coalesced, Hatch says. People across the political and demographic spectrum have been unified by a similar feeling of outrage and heartbreak. each motivated by issues that are important to them, whether it's police brutality, Trump immigration policies like family separation, or issues like access to healthcare and student loan debt. Hatch believes the sense of unity among groups that helped elect Biden will last, especially because of the recent attack on the Capitol. But she says Biden still has to use his slim Democratic majority in Congress to deliver.
Democrats should be very aware that there's an expectation that people's lives will be improved on a host of different issues because they are in the majority.
Hatch says there's a reason her organization is independent from Democrats, so it can hold them accountable.
What promises will this new Democratic majority be able to actually keep? How do we prioritize issues? Democrats have to begin to figure out how they're going to deliver for that coalition if they hope to hold that majority for longer than 2 years. And that will involve negotiation and back and forth and sometimes criticism.
That encapsulates what Leah Greenberg says is the prevailing attitude among groups like hers that mobilize voters. She's co-founder of the nonprofit Indivisible.
I think what we're seeing is that people want to both cheer President Biden on and they want to make him be bold. And they're coming at that from a supportive but pressuring angle.
She says the anti-Trump coalition believes Biden must succeed, and they think he can only do that by addressing structural problems in U.S. government.
And that is the flaws in our democracy that causes people to be underrepresented, locked out of political representation, and that then breeds cynicism in regular folks.
If the coalition that defeated Trump remains unified and keeps pushing, Greenberg says it ultimately could help defeat right-wing authoritarian figures around the globe.
What I would hope is that the defeat of Trump and the successful transfer to Joe Biden is part of a broader wave turning back this right-wing ethno-nationalist current.
If the U.S. can make the reforms necessary to represent and care for all its people, Greenberg says, it may help countries keep strong men like Trump from taking power again. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
Today's inauguration had some famous cultural icons, J-Lo, Garth Brooks, Lady Gaga, and one name that was lesser known before today, but she will be remembered for a long time to come. 22-year-old poet Amanda Gorman, she stood at the dais on Capitol Hill, where 2 weeks ago a mob rioted, where minutes earlier Biden took the oath of office. And Gorman recited her poem, "The Hill We Climb." Here's an excerpt.
The loss we carry, a sea we must wade. We've braved the belly of the beast. We've learned that quiet isn't always peace. And the norms and notions of what just is isn't always just is. And yet the dawn is ours before we knew it. Somehow we do it. Somehow we've weathered and witnessed a nation that isn't broken, but simply unfinished. We, the successors of a country and a time where a skinny black girl descended from slaves and raised by a single mother, can dream of becoming president only to find herself reciting for one. And yes, we are far from polished, far from pristine, but that doesn't mean we are striving to form a union that is perfect. We are striving to forge our union with purpose, to compose a country committed to all cultures, colors, characters, and conditions of man. And so we lift our gaze not to what stands between us, but what stands before us.
22-year-old Amanda Gorman reciting her poem, "The Hill We Climb," at today's inauguration. One of the main highlights of the event. Spend some time immersing yourself in the entire poem. We have that for you at theworld.org. More global reaction to today's inauguration of Joe Biden as president. That's still ahead. We also start unpacking some of his day one executive orders on climate and immigration. That's coming up next. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Out of the gate today, newly minted President Joe Biden is proposing a raft of immigration measures that start to undo what Donald Trump did over the past 4 years. One highlight of Biden's immigration plan concerns DACA, deferred action for childhood arrivals. As you know, DACA has helped hundreds of thousands of undocumented immigrants. Biden's plan opens up a path for them and many others to citizenship. Juan Escalante is a campaigns manager at Forward.us, an immigration advocacy group based in Washington. Juan himself is a DACA recipient. So let's start with DACA, Juan. I'm wondering if it's your hope that you're standing the U.S. and that of many others. Is it going to move? I mean, do you see this as moving from something temporary to something permanent now?
Part of the notion and the education that we have had to do over the past 4 years is this idea that the program was permanent. Right. My hope here is that the Biden administration recognizes the vulnerability of this program and not just signs an executive order, but rather pushes legislation at every corner and avenue that they're able to ensure that this program is codified into law and that the protections that allow us to work, drive, and be productive members of this country and society continue to remain in place while granting us a pathway towards citizenship.
So is what Biden is proposing, would it cover your parents who are undocumented? And is that part of the kind of incomplete picture for you?
I think when you drill down specifically, yes, my parents would be in that specific category. But I would also essentially, I'm a Venezuelan national. I arrived from Caracas, Venezuela when I was 11 years old with my family. And just last night, we saw that the president of the United States at the time, Donald Trump, issued an order creating a type of deferred enforcement departure for Venezuelans currently in the United States.
And what does that mean exactly?
This program would essentially provide some type of relief in 18-month increments for my parents specifically and for Venezuelans currently in the United States as of today.
That was proposed by Trump yesterday?
That is correct. At the 11th hour, we see that the president, after demonizing immigrants, kind of had a change of heart and essentially issued this executive order at the 11th hour. And it's yet to be seen what the impact holistically will do.
What else stands out for you, Juan, in Biden's plans to overhaul immigration?
I think one of the biggest one has been essentially the disintegration or undoing of the migration policy protocols that essentially trap people in Mexico awaiting claims to asylum. We're also seeing willingness to revive the entirety of the asylum and refugee program, something that the Donald Trump administration undid as much as they possibly could. It's the willingness of the Biden administration to show that they're not just using it as a talking point to try to show good grace and goodwill to some of the voters who worked really hard in Florida, Georgia, and in other states to combat a lot of the anti-immigrant sentiment that we saw from this past administration, rather.
So to the practical side of getting this immigration legislation passed, Juan, Democrats narrowly control both chambers of Congress. Mr. Biden obviously is going to need bipartisan cooperation on this, especially in the Senate. So what about pushback from powerful players in Congress? What are you hearing?
My suspicion here as of today is that should this bill become a no-go, that the administration will try to work with Congress to find other avenues to try to put as much of those pieces of this major proposal in other vehicles to push towards reform. Obviously, the Senate continues to be a challenge. And I know that I've said this in years past, but after seeing what has happened and the cruelty and horror unleashed by the Trump administration, there shouldn't be anything but urgency to try to tackle this issue as broadly as possible, as soon as we can, through Congress or through executive action.
Juan Escalante, campaigns manager at Forward.us, an immigration advocacy group based in Washington. Thank you for speaking with us today, Juan.
Thank you for having me.
President Biden today called climate change one of the cascading crises America faces as he takes office.
A cry for survival comes from the planet itself, a cry that can't be any more desperate or any more clear. And now,
his first day as president reflects that urgency. Today, he's signing on to rejoin the Paris Climate Agreement and issuing sweeping executive orders to reverse the previous administration's legacy of environmental deregulation. The World's environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler, joins me to talk about this big shift. What signal is Biden sending to the world with these actions today?
Well, the U.S. has spent the past 4 years as what some people in the climate world have called a rogue state, frankly, an obstacle to the global push to tackle climate change. Biden's day one actions signal that the administration wants to rejoin the rest of the world on the push against climate change and that he plans to back up his international promises with domestic action, starting by reversing a whole bunch of changes that the Trump administration made.
Let's start with the Paris Climate Change Agreement. Countries including China are already welcoming the U.S. back to the fold. That's a change that's basically going to take effect immediately, correct?
Just about. All it takes is a letter from Biden to the U.N. saying we want back into this global accord to help reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And then in 30 days' time, the U.S. will be back in. But that's just the very beginning. Table stakes, as one of my sources told me. The U.S. will also in the next year be expected to submit a new target for how much it can cut carbon emissions over the next decade. And then importantly, also supply the domestic policy changes that will help make that goal realistic. So rejoining is really step one.
Biden today is also signing an order to revoke the permit establishing the Keystone XL pipeline, which President Trump had approved to transport crude oil from Canada to the U.S. This has been an ongoing battle for activists and environmentalists here in the U.S. What's the reaction been in Canada?
So activists and environmentalists in Canada are also pleased. The struggle against the Keystone XL pipeline for them has kind of become a stand-in for the struggle for the energy future of North America. But the government in Canada is not so pleased. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has said he wants to speak to Biden about this. And the premier of Alberta, the province that considers this pipeline essential to expanding oil production in that province, has said that they're going to sue for financial damages if this reversal actually happens. So this could be a sticking point between two very strong historic allies.
So these two moves, the Paris Agreement and depermitting Keystone XL, I mean, the president can enact these with a stroke of a pen. How easy will the rest of Biden's day one environmental actions be to push through?
So it varies from action to action. Some are going to be relatively quick and easy. Some are going to be mired in more regulatory muck. For example, Biden is issuing a moratorium on oil and gas drilling in Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. But permits for oil extraction were just given out there yesterday from the Trump administration. So it remains to be seen whether those will ultimately be honored. Among the dozens of other environmental directives that Biden is handing out today, including telling the EPA to consider revising vehicle emission standards and methane emission standards. Some of those are likely to be somewhat simple. Some will be more complicated.
So the environmental orders released today by Biden are really sweeping. The administration directs agencies to look at any changes under Trump that were harmful to public health or damaging to the environment. I mean, that's pretty all-encompassing.
Yeah, Marco, we of course expect these day one executive orders, especially if the White House is changing parties. But nowhere do the Biden and Trump agendas differ more starkly than on climate change. And almost nowhere was the Trump administration more effective at enacting its agenda than on climate change and the environment. So the policy changes here are particularly whiplash-inducing and numerous.
Well, stay on it. The World's Environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler, thanks so much.
Thanks, Marco.
More stories about how today's transition of power is landing around the globe, still coming up here on The World. President Biden's schedule tomorrow includes a service of worship. A Yemeni-American will offer a Muslim prayer.
It is one that is praying for the soul of our nation and our people and encouraging people to do good.
We'll hear how she's experienced the past 4 years and is now looking forward. Coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Since Election Day, we've been checking in with our reporters abroad to see how the transition of power in the U.S. is being viewed globally. Today, as the new administration begins, let's see how it could set the stage for the next 4 years. I'm joined by The World's reporters Orla Barry in London, Lydia Manalidu in Athens, and Jorge Valencia in Mexico City. Let's start with a message from Biden's address today that the U.S. is ready to lead the world again. As you're seeing people responding to the inauguration where you are, is your sense that the world is willing to follow again? Orla, let's start with you.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, President Trump's departure and the incoming Biden administration was one of the main talking points at the EU Parliament meeting today. And this isn't necessarily unusual for them to talk about events like this, but the frankness with which some MEPs talked about it is particularly striking because the EU, as you know, is famed for its diplomatic speak. But have a listen to the EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen in her opening remarks in Parliament.
This new dawn in America is the moment we've been waiting for so long. Europe is ready for a new start with our oldest and most trusted partner.
And your question, Marco, you know, is the world willing to follow the president of the EU Council, Ursula von der Leyen's colleague, Charles Michel, went on to say that this transatlantic relationship has greatly suffered in the last few years and that America seems to have changed and how it's perceived in Europe and the rest of the world has changed. And he said now the EU must take our fate firmly into our own hands and not wait for permission to take its own decisions.
Lydia, what are you seeing where you are in Athens, both how people are following this day and whether they'll see the U.S. as a leader down the road?
In Greece and in the region, people have been paying close attention all day to the inauguration. A lot of channels here were carrying the inauguration and the speeches live. And in this coverage, one thing I kept hearing over and over was this description of today as the beginning of a healing process for a wounded country. These were words that hosts and analysts on Greek TV were using. And, you know, over the last 4 years here, there's been a lot of surprise and disappointment at the policies and rhetoric that have been coming out of the U.S. And obviously, there's been a lot of shock in response to the insurrection on the Capitol a couple weeks ago. And people today were commenting on the contrast between what the Capitol looked like then on January 6th and what it looked like today. So there is a sense that this is a new beginning, but that the U.S. has a lot of healing to do before it does any leading.
And Jorge, how about you? What was Mexico seeing and feeling today?
Well, Marco, I think it's a very good question about whether Mexico and countries across Latin America will follow any leadership. I don't think it's a radical idea to say that there will probably be more cooperation with a Biden administration and the State Department under his nominee, Antony Blinken. There certainly were people across the continent who were watching Joe Biden's first speech as president. TV networks in Mexico and in Colombia were broadcasting it live with simultaneous interpretations. The main news websites in Brazil and Argentina, they were reporting the headlines on the landing page of their websites. And here in Mexico, President Andrés Manuel López Obrador is somebody who very much as part of his persona is to be somebody who weighs very little on foreign issues and says that he only really cares about Mexico, not so much about what happens outside. But despite that, he had something to say about Joe Biden's inauguration this morning.
Provecho para desear que todo salga muy bien, que esta ceremonia se lleve a cabo con tranquilidad, con paz.
So here, López Obrador in his daily news conference says that he wanted to take the opportunity to wish Joe Biden a peaceful inauguration. Obviously, that's a nod to the insurrection that we saw just a few days ago, and that he also wished him good luck in his presidency. So certainly the United States, for as much soft power, as they say in diplomatic circles, as much soft power as the United States may have lost in Latin America, many are watching to see what Joe Biden does.
So some of the reactions to today's ceremonies in Washington, a new administration is going to signal some major policy changes that affect the parts of the world you all cover. In Greece, where you are, Lydia, what could that mean?
One of the big issues here in this region is how the U.S. is going to deal with Turkey, which, as you know, is a NATO member and Greece's neighbor to the east. There's been a lot of regional friction with Turkey because they've been sending ships to drill for oil and gas in waters claimed by Greece and Cyprus. And there's also been a lot of tension between the U.S. and Turkey lately over a number of issues, including Turkey's purchase of a missile system from Russia, over human rights abuses, Turkey's recent military action in Syria. And this all came up at yesterday's confirmation hearing for Antony Blinken, Biden's pick to head the State Department. So New Jersey Senator Bob Menendez said that Trump has been coddling Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and asked about the new administration's approach. Here's Blinken.
The bottom line is that Turkey is an ally that in the many ways you cited is not acting as an ally should. This is a very, very significant challenge for us, and we're very clear-eyed about it.
And at one point during the hearing, Blinken suggested that the U.S. would consider strengthening sanctions on Turkey. A lot of people in this region want to see that, so this has gotten a lot of play here today, and it's something people here in Greece and in the region more broadly are going to be watching.
All right, so Washington making headlines on both policy and the inauguration. And when it comes to how cooperation between the U.S. and Latin America could move forward, what are you seeing from your perch in Mexico City, Jorge, starting with Mexico?
Well, Mexico is, on a day-to-day basis, the United States' most important ally because of the long border, because on and off, Mexico is the number one trading partner for the United States. There are some 38 million Mexicans living in the United States. So if Joe Biden succeeds in his promises to slow down the spread of the coronavirus, stimulate the economy, that certainly bodes well for Mexico. And then, of course, there are Biden's promises on immigration reform, which Mexico is also paying attention to because there are many millions of Mexicans who are living in the United States who are undocumented. Similarly, many people from the Venezuelan diaspora, for them, it's also very important because of what Biden has said regarding temporary protected status for Venezuelan refugees. Now, if we go a little bit farther south in the continent, if we go to Brazil, it'll be very interesting to see how the presidency of Joe Biden and the presidency of Jair Bolsonaro interact, because Joe Biden has said that for him, the environment is a top priority. Many have said that Jair Bolsonaro has had a disregard for the environment and for the Amazon. So it will be very interesting to see how the Biden administration is able to work with Jair Bolsonaro on this particular issue.
Orla, what policy changes under Biden are grabbing people's attention in the UK?
Yeah, in terms of policy changes, what you hear talked about a lot here is climate change. You heard it in the EU Parliament this morning. You heard it from British MPs today. There is this huge sense of relief, I guess, that Joe Biden is signing back up again to the Paris Climate Change Agreement. And from Britain's perspective, it's also good news because Britain is hosting the COP26 summit, the UN's climate change conference in Glasgow later this year, and also the G7 summit, where climate change is expected to be on the agenda. That's being hosted in Cornwall in England in June. These are two big world events for Britain. And by the way, the expectation is this is the first time that Joe Biden will have a face-to-face with Boris Johnson. Although I should say, Marco, the British Home Secretary, Priti Patel, was saying this morning that Johnson and Biden have already built up a strong working relationship, which is fairly open to interpretation, I guess, because, well, first of all, it's thought that Biden took a quite unfavourable view of Boris Johnson and his campaigning for Brexit, and also of Johnson's relationship with Trump. And secondly, I guess I'm not sure Joe Biden would have had that much time over the last few weeks to be building a relationship with Boris Johnson. I imagine that Joe Biden had other things on his mind over the last few weeks.
The World's reporters, Jorge Valencia in Mexico City, Lydia Manalidou in Athens, and Orla Barry in London. Thank you all very much.
Thanks, Marco.
Thanks, Marco.
Thanks, Marco.
Biden's election and Trump's defeat will be scrutinized by political scientists and historians for years to come. All this year, the world zeroed in on one factor, the role Latino voters played in this election. A study out of UCLA this week is pointing to a nearly 31% jump in Latino voters in this presidential election over 2016. One of those voters is Iscan Ordaz Ortiz. He's a first-generation Mexican-American, and 2020 was his first presidential election. As part of our project on young Latino voters called Every 30 Seconds, Ordaz Ortiz shared his thoughts about the tumultuous month that led up to today with reporter Stella Chavez from KERA in Dallas.
Iscan Ordaz has been thinking about recent events, like the day a mob of rioters stormed the U.S. Capitol. The images he saw bothered him, scenes of people breaking windows, forcing their way into the building, some chanting Vice President Mike Pence's name. Rioters were angry he hadn't supported President Donald Trump. At first, Iscan was frightened to see such dangerous acts unfold in what was thought to be a highly secured area. But then,
I had to kind of remember that I am younger and in a sense more politically naive. So I assumed that things like this have happened before, just in a different light. There have been violent protests before and harsh disagreements from political parties before.
Still, he says, violence under any circumstance shouldn't be tolerated, and he doesn't like some of the rhetoric coming from both sides of the political spectrum.
You know, just a lot of polarizing commentary, and that was one thing that I was like just generally not very pleased with. Whenever I saw that pop up, it always elicits a lot of emotional reaction, right, as a reader, as a listener.
Iskan was glad to see some elected leaders take a stand. He points to Vice President Mike Pence, who, despite President Trump's insistence the election was stolen, certified the results, officially declaring former Vice President Joe Biden the winner. Iskan says he hopes the new administration will focus on helping get people back on their feet and bring the country together.
To just do his best to preserve some sense of political unity. And although that's no easy task, it would involve maybe just staying away from very, very irrational or unnecessary opinions towards different people.
Iskan considers himself a moderate politically, but sides more with Republicans on economic issues. He says he stays away from watching or reading what he describes as far right and far left views. Doing that narrows a person's worldview, and social media helps perpetuate these limited views, he says. Instead, Iskan says he likes to consume content that's helpful to him.
Hey everyone, me Kevin here. Biden has just released new information on his planned executive actions.
That's Kevin Pathrath. He's a 30-something real estate broker and investor and has his own YouTube channel known as Meet Kevin. Iskan says listening to Kevin is like watching a more experienced uncle who gets him thinking more like an investor. He also likes that Kevin focuses on other news and cites information from a range of news sources. And he doesn't seem to take sides, something Iskan wishes more people would do.
As a nation, we just don't look very strong right now. And so we need to just cut it out, agree to disagree, and go about our business.
Only then, he says, will the country truly move forward. For the world, I'm Stella Chavez in Dallas.
Stella Chavez joins me now from her home studio near Dallas, Texas. Hi, Stella.
Hi, Marco. It's great to be here.
So we just heard your update on Iskan Ordaz-Ortiz. You've been following him throughout the past year. What do you think Iskan's perspectives, his point of view, his political ideas, what do they show us more broadly speaking about the Latino electorate in Texas?
Well, I think it shows that the Latino vote is not monolithic, which is something many of us have been saying for a long time. But I just think it's really important to show how diverse and nuanced those political views are, especially among young people. I think that Texas in particular is really interesting. There are many conservative Latinos in many parts of the state. And a younger Latino electorate, you know, tends to be more liberal. But here we have Iskan, who's young, middle class, and he's actually more conservative than his parents.
You've told us before, Stella, that Iskan's parents lean more liberal. How did that dynamic at home shape Iskan's political views last year?
Iskan's parents were actually supporters of Bernie Sanders. And, you know, Iskan would talk about how he definitely didn't want to vote for somebody who was too far left. But I think that one of the things that really helped this relationship or this dynamic between Iskan and his parents is the fact that he is very calm and thoughtful when he speaks. And his parents are very respectful of his views, his ideas. And I think I should add that, you know, part of what's influencing Iskan is that, you know, he lives in North Texas. He lives in a more of a like suburban area, you know, middle class. His friends, people he knows, I mean, that all plays a role in influencing his views.
How did conversations go between Iskan and his parents? I mean, Iskan is a moderate, his parents supporting Bernie Sanders on the left side of the Democratic Party. Did it get feisty at all?
I never saw that. That's not to say it didn't happen, but I never saw it. I mean, I did ask more than once. I asked his parents, you know, what's it like to have a son who's actually, you know, a little more conservative than you guys? And, you know, the one thing that they kept going back to was the fact that they're very proud of Iskan because he's very thoughtful and analytical, and he reads a lot and listens to a lot of different things. And so they feel like, you know, he's doing what he needs to do to shape his own worldview. And so, you know, like I said, I never saw any arguments while I was there. But of course, like any family, I'm sure that there may have been some heated discussions at some point.
After a year speaking with and following Iskan, what is your takeaway about this young voter?
Well, he's been through a lot. I mean, as many of us have. What I think is interesting, or was interesting about following a young, you know, first-time voter was the fact that, you know, Iskan hasn't really lived through many historic moments. Like, you know, you and I, Marco, you know, we remember, at least I remember really well where I was on 9/11. And I know how that helped shape me as a person and as a journalist. And so for Iskan, you know, he's not only experienced, you know, the pandemic, but also he participated in Black Lives Matter marches. You know, he graduated from high school, started college, and voted for the first time in a presidential election during a very tumultuous time. And so I don't know how, you know, going forward, how that, you know, what kind of impact that's going to have on him. But I do know right now he's been very good about paying attention to everything that's happened. And he definitely has his views about things. And you know, I think he's just hoping for the best going forward.
Reporter Stella Chavez with KERA in Dallas. Thank you for your time, for bringing us Iskan's story. And thanks very much for being part of the Every 30 Seconds Project.
Thank you, Marco. I really enjoyed it. It's been a pleasure.
The world's year-long focus on the next generation of Latino voters is critical context for the quickly changing dynamics of the times we're living in. Find more from our Every 30 Seconds Project and the rest of our reporting on the presidential transition at theworld.org. This week marks a major shift in the U.S. pandemic response globally. Tomorrow, Biden's chief medical advisor, Dr. Anthony Fauci, will give remarks as head of the U.S. delegation to the WHO, the World Health Organization. On our show earlier this month, Dr. Fauci spoke of the need for global solidarity.
You have to have interconnectedness with regard to cooperation, collaboration, and solidarity, because viruses, particularly viruses like SARS-CoV-2, that are spectacularly efficient in their ability to transmit, they don't know borders.
This change in tone starkly contrasts with the approach taken by President Trump. He pulled out of the WHO and has been extremely critical of the organization's soft response to China. This change is not lost on Ilona Kickbush, founding director of the Global Health Center at the Graduate Institute in Geneva. She's a consultant to the WHO and has been active in the organization for years. Ilona, as you observe these developments from Geneva, as the Biden-Harris administration indicates it intends to work directly with the WHO and support this humanitarian response to the pandemic, what does that mean for the WHO and the global effort to respond to the pandemic?
Well, Marco, it's incredibly good news. And it's, of course, the news that everyone has been waiting for. And when we heard that Dr. Fauci would actually head the delegation at the executive board, I think many people were even more relieved. There are some really, really urgent things where the World Health Organization, and that means the countries, need the United States. And then, of course, there's a number of longer-term projects in relation to pandemic preparedness and response where one needs the United States on board.
Well, it's interesting. Earlier this week, the WHO director issued a stark call for help from the global community to support COVAX, which is this initiative to ensure equitable access of COVID-19 vaccines. The U.S. has been notably absent in COVAX, but many countries' wealthier ones have raced to the front of the line in getting vaccines. Biden's team has indicated the U.S. plans to join COVAX. What does it mean to have the U.S. reengage in that effort?
It's an enormously important signal, first of all. Second, of course, it really is a great help to COVAX, because we understand that $4 billion U.S. dollars are being made available. And it will be a motivator also for many of the other richer countries to support COVAX and to support it in a variety of ways. Of course, there's the hard cash. But then, you know, there is logistics, there is political support, there are so many things that need to be done. So this could really, you know, in the literal sense of vaccines, be a shot in the arm for COVAX and bring many more on board.
Ilona, given Trump's attitude toward the WHO, will the U.S. under Biden be in a position to critique the WHO on real internal problems at the organization? For example, an honest questioning of the relationship with China when it comes to pandemics?
Well, of course. I mean, that's how health diplomacy works. But there are two sides to this. The one side is, you know, what you do over Twitter and what you do in negotiations. And the other is that in the past, of course, no matter what the differences of countries have been in terms of geopolitics or ideologies, they have in most cases managed to work together on health so that the whole world is protected. We must move away from a blame game, otherwise the whole world really gets the problems and is sicker and unsafer.
Ilona Kickbush, founding director of the Global Health Center at the Graduate Institute in Geneva, also a consultant to the WHO. Really good to have you with us today. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Marco.
One of the first actions President Trump took 4 years ago was to ban travel to the U.S. from a handful of countries, including several majority Muslim nations. Tomorrow, by invitation of the Biden administration, a Yemeni American will recite a Muslim prayer during the 59th presidential inaugural prayer service, which this time will be virtual. Debbie Amontasser is the person selected to do that, and she joins us now from New York. Debbie, what does it mean for you to be reciting a Muslim prayer at the president's inaugural worship service?
Thank you for having me on the show. This is an incredible opportunity for me and American Muslims, and most importantly, the Yemeni American community that has actually been inflicted by the Muslim ban in the last 4 years.
We need to mention that you're also an activist in the Yemeni American community. 4 years ago, you protested Trump's travel ban by organizing the shutdown of about 1,000 Yemeni-owned grocery stores in New York. That was some powerful organizing. We covered it at the time. How do you look back at that event now?
One of the most incredible things that has come from that movement is actually a form of activism where we see Yemeni Americans all over the country, very civically engaged in their communities politically. You know, since that bodega strike, we actually formed an organization that was birthed out of that strike called the Yemeni American Merchants Association.
So from that shutdown, a lot of things have materialized. One of President Biden's first priorities is undoing the so-called Muslim travel ban with an executive order. What is that going to signal to Yemeni Americans and to people in Yemen?
You know, it's going to signal to Yemeni Americans and Yemenis across the world who are refugees, you know, separated from their Yemeni American families. It truly sends a signal of embracing immigrants and welcoming people, which this country has always done. And now it's going to go back to doing that and ensuring that every person has that opportunity.
Debbie, how do you think your activism is going to change with the new administration?
My activism is going to change in ways that I think we will be able to get a lot done. I was very active, as well as others were very active in the last 4 years, but it was exhausting. But I believe with this administration that we will have an opportunity to make a great deal of headway in regaining the soul of our country and making sure that there are policies that we're committed to during the election that we will make sure to follow up on. So, for example, you know, tomorrow the Muslim ban is going to be repealed. We want to see, the diversity visas reissued. We also want to see this administration designate Arab Americans as minorities for better education and work opportunities. Since the aftermath of September 11, many Arab Americans have suffered greatly by discrimination and bias, and this would be a great gesture to really help them feel included and give them a leg up. In addition, and I would be remiss if I did not talk about my beloved homeland of my family, which has been for the last, 8 years war-torn with the war in Yemen. We, are looking forward to making sure that the Biden administration will keep its promise to restore the aid that Donald Trump last year cut by 40%, his promise to end the war in Yemen that has caused a humanitarian disaster and crisis beyond belief. And most importantly, his commitment to engaging Yemeni parties to find a solution and end the war and help rebuild the country.
Tell us why this prayer service, why is it important?
I believe this prayer service is important because it is a part of a tradition. But what I believe is very different about this moment is that this prayer service is coming right after 4 difficult years that have been inflicting pain to Americans from the hate, the white supremacy, the discrimination, the bias. You know, this prayer service for me and many others is a renewal. It's a prayer of renewed time and opportunity for our country to heal, for our country to regain its position in the world, and to really be a beacon of hope for many who seek to come to it and those who live in it.
Debbie, before we go, can you tell us about the prayer you'll be reciting tomorrow morning for the virtual presidential worship service?
So the prayer that I will be reading is actually a recitation from the Quran. It is one that is praying for the soul of our nation and our people and encouraging people to do good, to be rewarded in this life and the life after.
Is there a line or two from the prayer that is especially meaningful for you that maybe you could share with us?
There is. Hold on a second. Sorry. Let me just pull it up.
That's okay.
The one that really resonates for me and drives me every day to wake up and to give back to the world, you know, is this verse. So those of you who believe and donate will have a mighty reward.
Everybody has to pull an oar with this. We look forward to hearing the rest of it with tomorrow's prayer service. Debbie Almendhasser, Senior Advisor for the Muslim American Advocacy Organization, MGAGE. Thank you so much, Debbie.
Thank you.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman, and we'll see you back here tomorrow.